session number 4597, reel number 6.
Colonel Shepherd, reel 6. Did you have any contact or did you visit any of the Jewish settlements when you were in Tiberias?
Yes, this is a particular time, it was when my wife was there, and we made up a party. I think it was 3 cars. We went down to Dagania, which is the oldest of all the settlements, and it was very interesting indeed. I had seen, of course, I'd been into some of the ones which had been recently set up, which were, they were literally fortified with posts on stilts at each corner and wired in and all the rest of it. And when they went out to the fields, they always had an armed guard with them and so on. But Dagania was very much more, as you could imagine, a little kind of suburb of outside a small town or something. It was well cultivated, there were a lot of trees growing, nice little houses, little kind of bungalow places. They showed us the creche. This was where the young children were taken, very early age, almost days after they were born, and brought up. The parents saw them just for a few hours at the weekend, and this was all. The other thing I remember very, very distinctly was that we were shown a small building. It was a very small building. And I asked what it was, and the man who was taking us round said very proudly, "Oh, that's our synagogue." And I looked at it, and I realized that not more than about half a dozen people could get in it at any one time, and so I asked him whether it was regularly used. And he said, "Oh, yes, the rabbi comes once a year, and he marries those people who happen to be living together at the time." And I gathered this was the way the synagogue, this was the main use of the synagogue.
Can you remember whether the Jewish communities or Jewish civilians you came across had a particular attitude to you as a British soldier?
I think that in a place like Dagania, which was well established and had obviously very good administration and a lot of very nice people working there, was rather different from some of the settlements, the newer settlements, where these unfortunate Jews from the Middle East had recently arrived and were living under pretty tough conditions and with a certain amount of danger. They had quite a different, they really had quite a different attitude, and I remember being told by one of my friends who had actually taken his platoon into one of these settlements and lived there for several days that he was rather shocked and rather angry when the girls who were serving the meal, the midday meal, refused to serve his soldiers. And he asked the reason, and he was rather rudely kind of put off by a remark, "Oh, well, of course, the British soldier," kind of thing, you know, "the scum of the earth," and this kind of thing, which was not exactly the right thing to say to people who were saving you from having your throat cut.
Did you ever have to actually go in and prevent an Arab attack on a Jewish settlement?
No. Our means of trying to control the country was to hunt down the guerrilla forces. And we did our best, particularly those officers who were with the special night squads and who operated from these settlements. We did our best to help train the Arabs to look after themselves.
How long did you stay in Tiberias?
Well, we moved from there, I can't remember the exact date, but we moved from there, I think probably it must have been when the hot weather came, which would have been about July or August. To a camp outside Acre. This was known as Old Trafford, rather inevitably, because of Manchester Richmond. It was wired, it was a tented camp on a little bit of high ground, not in sight of the sea, unfortunately, but just off the road up to the frontier from Acre.
And did you set this camp up yourselves, or was it there already?
Yes, yes. A company was in Acre, and I think they built the camp for us, and we moved two of the companies and the headquarters from Tiberias into Acre, into this camp near Acre.
Do you know what the reason for moving from Tiberias to Acre was?
No, I think it might have been that it gave us that we couldn't get out of Tiberias without being. It was very obvious when we got on the move from Tiberias, because there were only three roads. Whereas from Acre, I think possibly once we got out, we might have been going in almost any direction. Obviously not towards the sea, but I think possibly it may have given us more freedom from that point of view. It also certainly avoided the very hot and kind of unpleasant conditions down at the Sea of Galilee during the hot weather.
And the sort of duties that you had to perform when you were in Acre?
Well, we're exactly the same. There would be column, going out with columns, cordon and search, and so on. There was one very unpleasant thing which happened while we were there, quite early in the morning, and there was an explosion, obviously, across the bay, and from the direction of Haifa, and we turned out, I think, something like a company. It took us a little time to get there, because it was about 15 miles by road. And when we got there, we found that a very large amount of explosive with a lot of old rusted bolts and things had been hidden in a pile of oranges in the orange market and exploded. And a lot of people had been killed or wounded. I think the figures were, I can't remember, it was well over 100. And it was all very unpleasant.
What was the target, do you think?
Well, I think it possibly was a reaction by the Jews against the Arabs, but of course it was entirely indiscriminate. I don't know. It was mostly Arabs who were killed and wounded.
What was Acre itself like?
Well, Acre is historically is a very interesting place. You know, Napoleon tried to capture it, and there was a mound outside which was known as Napoleon's Bonaparte's mound or something. I remember looking at this and trying to reconstruct the scene. But once you got into Acre, it's a tiny little kind of port place on the edge of the north end of the bay there, and very kind of condensed. It's very built up, almost fortified, and there was a jail there, I remember. That was one place. We used to have to go in to draw the pay for the regiment. I remember being orderly officer on one occasion and being told, you take two trucks, a couple of machine guns, and X number of men, and you have the sergeant with you, and so on. You put pickets up on the roofs overlooking the road. It was a place where you're very conscious that you're completely shut in. You get it's a little narrow road and so on. And this was Acre. I mean, it was all like that.
What exactly were the details of going to draw the pay, the kinds of precautions you would take?
Well, you under those conditions, you want to be able to carry the pay out, put it in your truck, and drive off without any incident taking place. And you do it as a military operation. You have the door of the bank covered by a couple of men. You have your trucks pointing outwards with your machine guns mounted and so on, and there's no trouble. Do it any other way and you might be in trouble.
How long did you stay in Acre?
Well, we were told that our next posting was in Singapore, and we left Galilee on the 25th of September. In fact, the battalion left by train, I'm sorry, they embarked at Haifa on the Dilwara for Singapore, and we were relieved by our first battalion, the Essex Regiment. When it happened that on one of these operations a friend of mine had been killed, and he had been nominated to go back to the depot as the training officer, the depot sultan training officer. I was told I'd have to take his place, and so I was left behind. Well, now, after the battalion had sailed, I was told that they were not going beyond Egypt, because it was the time of the Munich crisis, and they got to Port Said. They were held up there, and they were then disembarked after a couple of days and sent to Cairo, and almost as soon as they got there they were told in fact that they would go back, get on the ship and go off to Singapore. They finally sailed on the 4th of November, and by this time the crisis was settling down. Well, I of course was left back in Haifa, waiting for a ship to go home. And as soon as I heard the battalion had been halted in Egypt, I rejoined them. In fact, I managed to get a ship, and I got back and I rejoined the battalion. And as soon as I rejoined the battalion, of course they went off again, and so my original posting stood. And meanwhile, during the short time I'd been in Haifa without a job, I contacted the brigade signals officer, who's a friend of mine, and he'd given me the highfalutin appointment of officer commanding inland communications, which barely meant that I had a job without an office or a car or anything, but at least it was a job. If anything happened, I had a job to do. Anyhow, that's by the way. And I rejoined the battalion, as I say, within a few days they were off again. And I found myself appointed with the three of us. There was Major Ian Jacob, later Sir Ian Jacob, Bill Usher, the adjutant, who was going back to England to the depot, second in command, and myself. And we were then appointed to take over the military command in the Aquitania. Now, the Aquitania had done a bolt from England to get into the Indian Ocean if war broke out, and it arrived at Port Said, and it was full of reinforcements. It had got the lot. It got marines, got signals, got soldiers, it had got sailors, it had got nurses, got every imaginable type of reinforcement. It got war stores all over the place. It was loaded up, and it reached Port Said, and then the crisis was over, and so it turned round and was going to go home. Now, we were put on as the ship's staff, as the military staff. Ian Jacob was the commandant, took command. Bill Usher was the adjutant, and I was the, well, I did everything else. I was in charge of the all the baggage, everything. I did all the dirty jobs. The main advantage I found of being in that situation was that I was able to look after my own baggage. And there was a splendid master-at-arms who was an ex-marine warrant officer who I got on very well with. And he and some volunteer marines from amongst the reservists and I, we used to go down into the hold practically every day and spend several hours a day sorting out all the kit which had just been thrown in willy-nilly, because there were people getting off at various places, at Malta, at Gibraltar and so on, and we had to sort all this out. And that's really how I spent most of the voyage, just trying to sort things out. And we arrived at Southampton, if my memory is correct, well, anyhow, I do remember we arrived in a snowstorm, and I had, I remember joining the depot on the 14th of December. I had about 3 days leave, and I went straight up to the depot. And at that stage, we were certainly, it was 38, and we were right in the middle of making plans for mobilisation. The first job I was given almost was to set up a program for the depot being turned into a machine gun training centre, a machine gun training program. The quartermaster became ill. I had to take over acting quartermaster, and we had a test mobilisation. Several hundred reservists arrived overnight, and they had to be kitted and all the rest of it. And that's how it went on till the outbreak of war, when I was given a company, training company, and I had to start all over again.
When you were in Palestine, did you do any travelling around?
We went to Jerusalem, I remember, with my wife. I knew one of the senior signals officers, I'd got to know him, and he had a house in Jerusalem, and he was going off to Cairo on a conference, and he very decently said, if we'd like to go and live in his house for a week or so, this would be fine. And so we went down there by train, and we lived in this house, which got servants and everything. It was very comfortable, and we used to spend our time walking around, seeing the sights and so on, which was very exciting. And I kept on seeing the same man every day, kind of, you know, wandering about. And it wasn't until I got back to the unit that I realized and was told that the special branch had put a corporal on to see it. I didn't get into any trouble. It was very nice of them.
What were your general impressions of Palestine after you had left?
Well, that it was A, it was very good training. B, I think the thing which I remember most is that certainly in the spring it's one of the most beautiful places that you could be in. I mean, the wildflowers are simply lovely. I felt also that it was a tragedy that you had this conflict. In many ways, I admire the Arab. When I'm talking about the Arab, I mean the proper Arab, the chap who lives in the desert and so on, not the town Arab, who is a very different kettle of fish. But the proper Arab is a man who will stick to his word, and I think he lives by very often by very strict moral laws and so on. And personally, I admire it. I also admired some of the Jews, because I think they had a very tough time. Some of them were not admirable, I think, because they themselves had had probably most terrible experiences. I mean, a lot of them, of course, were refugees from Middle Europe and so on, and they hadn't really had time to settle down to their new life, and they were very unpredictable and so on. I don't know if that's answered your question, but I had very mixed feelings about the place, except that it had great natural beauty. It, from a military point of view, from a point of view of soldiering, is very good training. And of course, as signals officer, I'd had a very good job, which was very exciting and very rewarding.
What sort of, by way of contrast, was your impression of Egypt and the Egyptians?
Well, Egypt wasn't quite such a nice place in many ways, although of course it was far more, you could walk about Egypt, there's no problem, I mean, at that time. I didn't really enjoy, I don't think, Egypt, because we had little opportunity of doing so. We were under canvas and virtually mobilized and kind of tied down most of the time there, very restricted, no leave until I was able to get back to get married and so on. And the sport wasn't all that good. I mean, we didn't have much time. Ismailia, or Almuesca, was not quite good fun. The French community were very pleasant. There were some very nice married families there and so on. We had our own little flat. That was better. But, I think at that age, you accept almost anything, don't you? you could make your own life and have a good time. But as a country, I didn't really enjoy it.
On a more general level now, did you find there was a great difference, say, between the relationships between officers and men once you were in the Middle East, by contrast to how it was when you were at the depot? Was it less formal or more formal?
The depot, of course, was after I was in the Middle East. Well, the depot is different insofar as the large majority are young recruits. You have experienced, trustworthy, in many cases excellent NCOs to deal with. And so your job is made easy, you have a routine, and so on. Your life is concentrated on trying to bring these recruits up to high pitch of efficiency. Now, one of our problems was at that time was that our recruiting area had been through, well, the country had been through a very tough time, but especially up in that part of the world, and a lot of our recruits were undernourished. Physically, they weren't good enough. I mean, they were the best we could find. And we actually had, and this is absolutely true, we had several extra weeks added to the normal period of recruit training to enable us to overcome this. And what we did, and I was a training officer, I know this quite well, was that when a man came in, of course, you know, you smartened him up, he had a bath, you gave him decent clothes, and he probably hadn't seen any leather shoes or boots for years, and you gave him boots and things to wear. You gave him jolly good food, put him in the gym, plenty of exercise, every afternoon he played football, and so on. And you didn't attempt really to teach him any soldiering for several weeks. And at the end of that time, he was a man. And of course, they loved it. They suddenly read. Once you get a chap under those conditions and you treat him properly like that and he feels he's a man, I mean, he makes the most marvellous soldiers. And then you can teach him anything.
And now, you find I'm this just, born out in the Middle East?
Oh, no. Well, you see, I didn't go back to the Middle East. My time at the depot, I'm talking about my own experience as training officer at the depot, was after I'd been in the Middle East. Now, in the Middle East, you were dealing basically with trained soldiers who'd been in the army, well, perhaps 3 or 4 years.
Had any of your men served in the Middle East before?
Well, I remember one case, which was perhaps rather, very much the exception. In fact, he was our provost sergeant, who, as a young soldier in the Great War, had been captured at Kut. And certainly he'd never forgotten those experiences, because he was marched across the desert without any boots and maltreated by the Arabs in quite a big way. And one might perhaps say that he was rather a bad choice of reserve sergeant at that particular moment, because his attitude towards any Arab who was in trouble or had to be arrested or taken under his care was very tough indeed. Although I don't think that there was any real serious trouble, he certainly used to chain them up and so on, and they got very little change out of him.
But on the whole, what sort of relationships did your men have with the local population?
Well, they had little opportunity of meeting them unless they were actually out on operations. You couldn't really move around. I mean, from billets, there was a curfew at night, and if they were out from the billet, they'd have to be armed and in pairs and so on. It was different. Well, I mean, the officers are the same. As I say, you always had two cars and that kind of thing. There was very little contact except during operations. Indeed, virtually none. But, I mean, we had no trouble. The discipline was very good, and we had no trouble at all.
And what was your general impression of British military in the Middle East during the time you were there?
Whether we were efficient in doing our job, or... I think under the conditions where, obviously, one was restricted, certain things you weren't allowed to do, although in fact we had a commanding officer who in fact was an Australian who after all it was his area, and he was the chief poobah, and his powers were pretty extensive. I think that within the kind of restrictions on us, certain things obviously you couldn't do, although we did do quite a few very unusual things. I think we did everything we could. There are two things I think might be of interest, and it's peculiar possibly to my regiment at this time. As I say, we had this commanding officer who was a very tough chap. He was a very good seer under those conditions. And one of the things he did was to send for the local village headmen occasionally, perhaps once every month or so. They'd all have to sit outside his tent while he kind of stayed in the tent, and then the adjutant would come out and say that he would come as soon as he was less busy or something. And then he'd eventually come out all dressed up in his polished boots and everything. He'd sit there and he'd look round this ring of headmen, and he'd suddenly catch the eye of one of them, and he'd say, "Now, Muhammad Ali so-and-so, I know jolly well that you murdered a policeman last week, and if you do it again, I'll come and I'll blow your village up." Now, that chap knew that this was something which might quite possibly happen, that he really meant it, or at least he meant most of it. And this kind of thing, everybody else, all the other chaps, of course, would laugh, you see, and they'd trick this unfortunate chap. Well, in fact, it was a very clever move, because in this way, he avoided a lot of trouble. Now, the other thing which we did, which was perhaps a little like, well, there were several other things. One, I think, was fairly common practice, but having surrounded a village at night, perhaps, you might catch a certain number of men in it. Most of the men would have run away. But those that you did capture, you took out of the village, and you marched them off, and you put them into a little wired compound, a little kind of prisoner of war cage, and you put a guard there, and then you would go back to the village and say where they were. And the effect of this was that the unfortunate women would have to go several times a day, quite long distance, backwards and forwards, to feed them, and so on. Now, after a few days, the women were so fed up with this that the men would probably come to an agreement, you see, and then the whole area would be quiet for about a fortnight or 3 weeks. Now, this was again something, I mean, it didn't really hurt anybody, it just made life a bit awkward. Well, then, our other thing which we discovered was that, of course, this business of the mining of roads was very worrying. I told you about the Ulsters having a truck blown up and so on. Well, we eventually cottoned on to the idea that when we were running a big convoy, we would send off a good NCO with some men down to a village nearby, and there you'd have all the kind of head men in the village sitting around drinking coffee and playing this funny kind of game they play, kind of checkerboard game. And you'd commandeer a couple of taxis, and the drivers would be handcuffed to the driving wheel of the taxi, and you'd select the two fattest Arabs, most senior fat Arabs, and you put them in the back of the taxi. And you put one of these taxis at the head of the convoy and another one somewhere down in the middle of the convoy. And then you start off. And under those conditions, we never had any trouble at all with our convoys.
And to conclude, what was your impression, or what do you think of the role that Britain was playing in the Middle East at that time?
Well, it was a mandate. We were bound by treaty to do what we could, and I think we did what we could.